Good evening, everybody. It's really great to be here with all of you. It really is quite an honor. And I say that, and I really mean it, because I think back, seeing you all talk about, this movement that you're moving forward in Vermont, in Washington, and think back how I first got involved, and when I first got involved in the Worker Center, it was in 1999. And I had been just getting involved in the Worker Center, and something happened over here that was really inspiring and really inspired a lot of us. The Battle of Seattle. I know there's folks here tonight that were down in the streets shutting down the World Trade Organization meetings. And that kind of movement of seeing forces come together, movements come together, labor movement and across different issues, really affected us, really raised our expectations of what kind of movement is possible and what kind of movement will be necessary to really fulfill the mission of our organization. In Vermont, the Vermont Worker Center got started in about 1998 officially. And we did a lot of really great work fighting for workers' rights and livable wages and helping nurses and nursing home workers and others organize unions, doing our part, fighting free trade agreements and so on. But we really felt that that we were just scratching the surface of what was needed to really fulfill our mission, to really have workers' rights and have the ability for people to live and work in dignity. And so we did a bunch of long-term planning, and it's really nice to be here on your 10th anniversary of your annual meeting, because at ours in 2008, we launched our Healthcare is a Human Right campaign. It was a big deal for us. We transformed as an organization. We became like kind of a workers' rights coalition mobilization organization to a grassroots base building organization, getting our communities organized to try to have the power to change what was politically possible. We knew that it was going to take a long time to do it. We had politicians that told people that they supported this, but when it came time to actually do it, there wasn't the political will, as was said here, and it sounded very familiar. And so, we said that we were just going to get out and get our communities organized. And we were also going to bring forth the stories of what the healthcare system right now, how people are experiencing it, and how the unjust realities of people not getting care when they need it, falling into medical debt, and all the various ways that right now our healthcare system is leaving people out and creating a lot of suffering, amounted to a human rights crisis. And that we would indict that system and then be able to use human rights and that framework to be able to have a system that was more in line with the values of our communities, that would be universal and it would be financed publicly and financed in an equitable manner. And it would also be accountable to communities and transparent. People could participate in the major decisions that were about universal health care. So it was a big goal that we set out to do. And we went around and we surveyed thousands of Vermonters. We ended up having these human rights hearings across the state to bring forth these stories. And then we ended up building for a huge rally at our state capitol, a Healthcare is a Human Right rally on May 1st, 2009. So we weren't really dealing with elected officials at that stage. We consciously said, we just want to get our communities organized and begin showing that a lot of people could act together and start raising expectations about what was possible. We had the biggest rally in the history of the state on a weekday at our state capitol with 1,200 people. Vermont's a little state that came out and on a weekday came and just had a massive rally. And then we started saying, okay, now we can start thinking about bringing this movement inside the state house and holding people accountable. And in the course of a few years, that what was politically possible began to change. One big thing happened that made it happen a lot quicker was our governor decided not to run. We had a Republican governor at the time. And so in that 2010 legislative session, when we had all this energy going forward, all of a sudden a bunch of ambitious legislators that were thinking about running in the Democratic primary for governor started getting very serious about trying to move forward for universal health care. We passed a law that was figuring out how Vermont can do this. During this time, while politicians were starting to change what they were saying about what was possible, on a federal level, from 2008 into 2010, we were watching the Affordable Care Act be carried out. And, you know, there was people in Vermont and beyond that were saying this was going to be the best thing that this country can do around universal health care or around health care reform. And, you know, we from the very start said this is not going to solve the health care crisis. We're going to still have people with insurance products that don't adequately cover them and their families. And Vermont had a responsibility to keep forward. So I will sort of fast forward through some of this stage so we can get to talking about where we're at right now. But essentially, in a very tight election, one of our very ambitious senators won in a primary by 500 votes. He was championing universal health care amongst five top candidates. Two of the other candidates were also very strongly championing universal health care. But he, you know, he won. He was unfortunately the guy that we probably trusted the least. He was, you know, very ambitious, one of the richest guys in the state. But he was using this. He saw the political expedience of doing this, and then he squeaked out a victory in the general election by 2,000 votes over our, you know, lieutenant governor, and went in to 2011. With saying, you know, I'm the guy that can get things done, healthcare is a right, and Vermont can lead the way. And that year we ended up passing Act 48, a law that would bring Vermont to having the first universal healthcare system in the country. One important piece as that kind of went through with this political momentum, we had a supermajority Democratic-controlled legislature at the time, was that the Democrats actually added an amendment in the Senate right before it got voted out that would have excluded undocumented workers. And in Vermont, that means thousands of dairy farm workers. And the governor's office and the legislative leadership, they all said this was, you know, impossible to get out. This was an amendment that they some reason had to have in there. And we said absolutely not. We had massive rallies. The May 1st rally that year was the biggest one ever. And 2 days later, on May 3rd, they actually removed the amendment, which was a tremendous victory, kind of on top of the victory that was happening. That was in a very interesting year. You know, Occupy Wall Street ended up happening that fall. We got smashed with a Hurricane Irene, which was, devastated a lot of like poorest areas of the state. Mobile home parks were built in the valleys and floodplains. And so, you know, our movement at that stage, we had to wait to 2017 because of the Affordable Care Act to actually implement a universal health care system. But, you know, many of people in the organization across the state were really seeing that we can't have a just health care system in an unjust society. And the effects of poverty are part of our right to health. As Margaret will probably talk about, the social determinants of health are a huge factor whether people are going to get healthy or not. So you could have a universal healthcare system, but if you have poverty that is, people are homeless and not getting the things that they need, then people still don't have the right to be healthy. So we started a broad movement called Put People First, working with a bunch of partner organizations, and we formed a human rights council and kept building a movement. We started pushing for this idea of a people's budget, which would change the way that the state goes about the whole budgeting process, which is kind of just, you know, taking whatever taxes they had the year before, seeing if they have enough money. They don't, so they cut incredibly important programs that our communities need. We said, you have to go out and talk to communities. What do community needs assessments and look about what are the priorities to make sure that people have the right to live and a healthy and dignified lives. And we were able to pass some statute with that as the clear goal of our state budget. And also, you know, we were thinking about how do we finance a healthcare system in a way that's equitable. And it's such a big endeavor. We're really talking about, you know, how do we have just taxation policies? How do we have the needs of our communities met? And so, we started a much bigger movement that we realized in Vermont, you know, wasn't just about passing one law, about passing two laws. It was about really having a people's movement that was capable of shifting things so that we could have a real democracy, that people were accountable and they weren't just giving us the lines that they thought we wanted to hear so they could get elected, but they were actually committed to doing it because we had the ability to hold them accountable. So this gets us to our situation now. We have continued forward. We've had some big victories with some of our partner organizations. But as this movement building work has grown, our governor has really shown his true stripes in many ways. he basically dangled this idea that he was going to do universal health care as a carrot to progressives, while he acted like a Republican in almost every other way. He killed the paid sick day bill. He cut programs, said he will not raise taxes on the wealthy, and we have to cut our welfare program, our reach up program for mothers, and really angered a lot of people. He did a bunch of other things, including his administration bungled the whole healthcare exchange. The website was a fiasco, security breaches, the media jumped all over it. And, like I said, people didn't really trust this guy all along. He's a smart politician, but, he's now become one of the more unpopular people. In this last election, he was running against literally no one, this guy that no one knew. He outspent him 8-1, and he was an incumbent, and he only won by 2,000 votes. It was the lowest voter turnout in the history of the state. And then he came out and said that he is not recommending that we move forward with universal health care. He said, the state can't afford it, even though that his job was not to make that determination. His job by the law was to bring forth a proposal about how we could move in this direction, and the legislature makes that determination. But he instead did that. He brought forth a non-recommendation. His administration actually had some good people working in there. We dug into this 80-page report, and they had actual proposals where 95% of Vermonters would benefit under this shift to public financing. And yet he said it was not a political decision but an economic decision. So we immediately had massive rallies. This was in December. We had a big rally the next day at his inauguration on January 8th. We brought a rally inside of the State House and ended up occupying the inauguration, and 29 people got arrested. And ended up having just their charges dropped a couple of weeks ago. This was, something that we needed to make sure that that the Democratic people that have been in power now in Vermont, having super majorities in both legislatures and the governor's office, knew that people were not going to stand for this, and that we were going to continue to make a political mandate to move forward. So that's where we're at now. The legislature let him delay coming out with this proposal for 2 years, and now they're letting him not move forward with his obligations under the 2011 law. We are continuing to build a movement right now that is joining with our state employees who are facing massive layoffs and cuts to important services. Next April 11th, a few Saturdays from now, we will be having another massive rally at the State House, and then building up to a mass action in March on May 1st down in Vermont. If you lived closer, I would really encourage you to come. Our spring will just be coming then. But we have our work cut out for us. I just wanted to say also that, we really see, this is really, inspiring to me to see you all, the work that you're doing here. I mean, it's just, like I said, back in 1999, that work, had impact across this country, across the world, and what you're continuing to do, fighting for Fight for 15 and Strike Poverty, and, all of that work is, we really do see it as one movement. Our victory in Vermont is only as good as it creating a movement for it happening in other states. I know there's been a lot of talk about, should we try to fight for this on a state level, or should we try to fight for it on a national level? And for us, there's no doubt that it makes a lot more sense on a national level. But we must fight where we can win to create momentum. And so we're going to do everything we can to be a catalyst by trying to win it in our little state. And we're just really super inspired to see all the work that you all are doing here. We'll need your support. It's going to be tough. We saw, in the last election, one of the other factors was a bunch of Koch brother money came in to scare a bunch of seniors about, what this would do to them, and sending mailings and phone calls and stuff, and it had an impact on a number of tight legislative races. And, we're starting to see, Vermont had not had that kind of campaigns before this past election, and we're starting to see it now. There's definitely people that want to stop us that are outside our borders. And so we really do believe that our movement has to have, you know, solidarity across all the states, across the borders. You know, I'm just really excited to continue to hear about all the work that you all do. You know, I think, you know, as Jim said, you know, we think there has to be a lot of dedication to a health, universal healthcare movement. It, you know, you can't just, you know, organize around everything. It takes a lot of focus. But it also can't be in isolation, because it is not an issue that stands alone. So it's just really excited to see all the tables out here with the Transit Union and Fight for 15 and all the great organizations fighting for things. And that's exactly what we're trying to foster up in Vermont. And, you know, I just am really excited to be here. I can't wait to come back. It's, you know, it can't be anything but a lot of jealousy. It snowed today in Vermont, so it was really nice to be here. Your spring is ridiculously beautiful. And, yeah, I'm just super excited to come back out here and celebrate more of our victories. Thanks very much.
I'm honored tonight to introduce City Council Member Shama Sawant. Her 15 months on the council have been at once both a breath of fresh air and a tornado for social justice.
Re-elect trauma.
Thank you all, sisters and brothers, for being here and for the speakers who preceded me, and especially the inspiring story from Vermont. And I think beyond inspiration, the lessons that we can learn, how their success was based on building, as James said, a people's movement. And I thank Sally for that really generous introduction, although I am humbled because she is an activist that I look up to. So I guess we inspire each other. We, all of us, do that. And I wanted to, I wanted to start by saying that if public mandate were the decider, then we should have had single-payer healthcare decades ago. And so the question that we should explore is why we don't have it. And just to give, just a glimpse, I know everybody in this room is on the same page, but just to give an idea of what that public mandate looked like for years and still looks like, a majority of the population at that time that Obama was discussing reform for healthcare was on the side of single-payer healthcare or a strong public option. You know, and forgetting the details aside, if you go to any ordinary rational human being who has the interests of themselves and their families and their community at heart, and you ask them, don't you think that this kind of social service, you know, healthcare is such a basic need, should be socially shared, and that the people at the top should be paying the most, and you know, we, the workers who make the city run, should be getting it for free, and our children should be able to have that, our elderly parents should be able to have that. Without a doubt, people are going to say yes. And it's not only ordinary people and workers and their families. It's a great number of physicians and nurses who've been on our side and who've been fierce and courageous advocates of this. And as a matter of fact, I mentioned that specifically also because in preparation for tonight, I asked Valentina Warner, who's a physician, can you wave your head? Yeah. And a good friend of mine, to write me a few words on what she thinks as a community clinic physician and the impacts of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, on her patients. She's a dedicated doctor. And her passion runs so deep that she gave me a long essay that I cannot read here. But I will be posting it on my council blog. But I urge you all to read this because it is a heartfelt account full of nitty-gritty of what it means to be a doctor. You go in the morning and you try to service your patients and the enormous obstacles that they're faced with. And she particularly points out the major loophole that happened where Medicaid ended up adopting for-profit insurance companies. And she mentions that Forbes cited one of them, United Healthcare, their CEO, as the 8th highest paid CEO in this country. It really highlights the depth of the problem. And as many people have already recognized, in 2000, this is just one statistic, There would have been over 83,000 fewer deaths of black people had we had some sort of public health care. As Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her scathing dissent on the Hobby Lobby case, said, the cost of an IUD is nearly equivalent to a month's full-time pay for workers earning the minimum wage, many of whom are women. And it could cost more than $1,000 out of pocket. So if you look at these stark numbers and you look at all the mandate that we have from people, from healthcare providers, we should have had this already. So the question we should focus on is, why don't we have it? What went wrong? And what should we be doing in the coming months and years? And I think just to lay out the overall picture of what happened in Washington, D.C. at that time, we saw the Republican Party and the insurance industry, the insurance lobby, going on an all-out war, a public war against the very idea of public health care. And they did that even though they knew that the deal that was coming was actually going to enrich them. Why did they do that? They denounced government-run insurance as un-American, as socialist, although they're right about that. You know, it is a socialist thing. But they also called it treacherous. They organized AstroTurf campaigns. And why did they do that? They did that because had they just accepted, we're going to get lots of good things from Obama anyway, so we can stay out of it, then they would have allowed the space for the activist movements to strike back and get enough room to organize and get some good things into the bill. What they did was completely suck out the air so that there was absolutely no question. There was no question. Single payer was off the table. And by contrast, what did the Democrats do? The Democratic Party establishment, which controlled both the legislative and executive branches at that time, they allowed the Republicans to dictate the agenda. And they did what they always do best, which is silence their left flank, and they kept moving their agenda to the right. And I know that is always presented as, they lack a spine. And they need to be coaxed into it. In today's discussion, there was a question of how do we persuade our political representative, our elected officials? I would say that the reality is not that they lack a political will. They do have political will. It's just that they're not fighting for us. Yeah. And to be clear, there are many genuine people who run as elected officials under the Democratic Party banner. Remember Dennis Kucinich? Yes. And there are millions of people who identify themselves as Democratic Party supporters, but have zero say in the agenda of the Democratic Party. When was the last time any of us who say we support the Democratic Party invited to a meeting to discuss policy, healthcare, or otherwise? And I think that the most important step that the single-payer movement should take, and it's already taking, is to recognize that bitter fact that as long as we have our hips tied to the Democratic Party establishment, we will not win single-payer healthcare. And if we need hard evidence of which way or which side the interest, the loyalty of the Democratic Party lies to, look at the historically high campaign contributions Obama got on his presidential campaign from Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, all of those heroes who sunk the global economy almost on the brink of an abyss. These are the people behind the White House and U.S. Congress. But we have to remember, activists who are on the forefront have to remember, we should not be going to the establishment for our approval or for mandate. We're never going to get that. We should go to where our strength lies, at the grassroots, people who are disenfranchised and left completely out of the system, but will be on your side if you go to them for power. And that is the approach of independent politics. The approach which says that on a purely, you know, statistical basis, if you look at what's happened in the last several decades, the labor movement, all the progressive organizations, the environmental movement, all those people who stand for social, racial, and economic justice and for environmental sustainability have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the Democratic Party establishment, you know, pulled out hundreds of thousands of foot soldiers every time a campaign comes around. And we have nothing to show for it other than a systematic string of betrayals. And that is why I think the most important message we have to take to the people that we are trying to empower, the people on the ground, working families, is the need, and the labor movement, rank and file workers, is the urgent need to make a clean break from the Democratic Party establishment and to draw towards us those who consider themselves Democratic Party supporters, but who can see in a glaringly clear way that that party establishment does not in any way speak to the values that we all hold. And I know that Sally already mentioned what we've done in Seattle, and I'm going to go back to that in the few minutes that I have left, because I think that in addition to what James talked about in the People's Movement in Vermont, these are examples, these are powerful examples of how if you build even the mere beginnings of independent politics, you can have a raving success. Imagine what we could do if all around the nation we had a huge political momentum away from the two big business parties and to build alternate political structures for the left. And it is important to say what it is. You know, often people say to me, I agree with you, we need a third party. And you know, I come from India. We have a multitude of parties, and not a single one of them represents the interests of the people I care about. And I always tell people, yes, we need a third party, but it matters what kind it is. We don't want the Tea Party, obviously. I wasn't meaning to joke, but but that begs the question, what is it are we looking for then? And that is why I'm going to use our own campaign, my own campaign. I say our because I don't see this as something that belongs to me or was done by me exclusively. This was a collective effort, as anything always is when you talk about social justice. But I go back to this example because it was such a clear example of what independent politics looks like. I called myself an open socialist. You don't have to do that. But what we did by using that relentlessly on the campaign, you know, people kept asking me, why do you always have to start a speech by saying I am a socialist? Because people were, there's a rational fear in people's minds, you know, after the Cold War propaganda, people thought, don't say you're a socialist, that's just going to doom your campaign. But we on the left, people who are here because you've been on the forefront of struggle for so long, it's important for us to realize it's a different world out there. The younger generation has nothing invested in this system, in the capitalist system, or in the elected officials that, you know, are littered around the political landscape. What the young people see is a system that is not working for them. They have entered a world in which capitalism is in its deepest recession since the Great Depression. There is no solution within capitalism on the horizon for this deep, deep international crisis. They see their lives being sort of engulfed in a darkness of low-wage jobs, student debt, and a really uninspiring dead-end kind of life, unless they engage in struggle. And they are looking for us. They are looking to struggle. And that is what we discovered through our campaign, that as a matter of fact, the conventional wisdom that you have to run a mild campaign and that you have to be very careful is not going to appeal to the people who want to fight with you. And what we did was lay out a framework for what an independent political campaign looks like. We said, this is a purely grassroots campaign. We take zero money from corporations. It was incredible how powerful that idea was. I mean, to me as a socialist, It seems, you know, very obvious and straightforward. There is no way I would ever take money from corporations. Not that they're dying to give me any money, because they're also rational. But in the context of this dystopian politics, where it is completely, bathed in corrupt corporate politics, the idea of running a strong grassroots campaign that boldly declares, "I'm not taking a penny from corporations," is so inspiring to people. That's the kind of campaigns we need. Campaigns where we don't worry about what is going to upset the corporate establishment of the local jurisdiction where you're running. And that's very important, you know, because we often talk about Republicans, but Seattle does not really have a Republican Party to speak of.
Right.
Thank goodness.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. But if you look at the situation of people in Seattle, mired in low wages, with a deepening crisis in housing affordability, and with a city council and a mayor's office that has systematically worked in the interests of corporate developers, and more of the inches of our land being taken over by Vulcan and Amazon.com, at whose doorstep does this scenario lie? It lies at the doorstep of the Democratic Party establishment. And that's very important for us to recognize, because it gives us a real opportunity to engage with people and say, this is what we're fighting against. We're fighting for a real idea of representing, a real representation for ordinary working people, a real representation for those who are marginalized, women, people of color, especially the black community, communities of color, the Latino community, the immigrant community. We are trying, we are showing that, and I, you know, I mentioned even the mere beginnings can strike fear into the hearts of the establishment and show actual results. With 1 year, and Sally said, you know, around 15 months in City Hall, we have showed that having even one person, one elected official, that has truly emerged from mass campaigns and mass movements and is truly accountable to our collective interests, even having one person has completely changed the political landscape of Seattle. And as Sally correctly said, that is precisely why they are going to go into all-out war against us this year. And the way they will do it is, of course, by isolating me and by casting personal slurs. But we have to remember that if we are here in order to fight effectively for single-payer healthcare and win the victories, and as everybody before me said, if you're fighting for single-payer healthcare, then you're fighting for all kinds of justice, because how can you fight for one and not fight for the other? All these are interconnected. And for that purpose, in order to achieve those victories, not only in terms of strong social reforms, but raising people's vision towards a systemic change, in order to do that, we have to ensure that we protect the gains of what we won here, build on it this year, and then have that be a sort of an electrifying impact on everybody. I guarantee you, if we win in November, it is going to have an earth-shattering impact internationally. But that's not important in itself. What's important about it is two things. One, the opportunity that it gives us to fight for further strong reforms in Seattle, but not just that, the opportunity to raise the morale of hundreds of thousands of people around us and to, you know, present the idea, a real concrete idea of independent politics, not in theory, but in practice. And I hope that you will all be with me all throughout this year and in the coming years forward. Thank you.
For inviting me back. I have to start out by saying I'm getting a cold, so I'm going to do my best and do my best to make sense to you tonight. But it's really, truly wonderful to be here because this is really a beautiful community, and I feel very welcomed. Thank you for inviting me to be here, and just I'm really enjoying the conversation tonight and thinking how I don't think that we would have this conversation 5 years ago. I think that it's really important for you to see how much you have moved and how much kind of the whole culture in this country is moving, where we're starting to see the importance of these connections and the importance of solidarity and of independent political movements. So give yourselves a hand for, you know, just you've really moved and in a direction towards social justice. So I feel like you guys know so much already, and you've done some really tremendous work here in Seattle. But what I wanted to do is kind of share with you some of the journey that I've had, because, you know, as we were in there in 2009, 2010, fighting for healthcare justice, seeing it as an opportunity to actually achieve what this country needs and what so many of us wanted, and saw up so close how that was just not going to happen in the current system. Since then, I've taken, I guess, if I think about it, it's really kind of a physician approach to, you know, social justice. It's about looking at the symptoms and trying to identify the underlying causes of those symptoms, and then what are the effective treatments, right? I'm not doing advocacy because I just like to do advocacy. I'm doing advocacy because I want to make a difference. So how are we going to make a difference? And I think it's really important for us to know, and it's been a real journey for me, and I've learned, you know, from people in this room, James, of course, and others. So it's constantly, as we're in this world of social justice, of activism, we need to be learning and learning from each other and learning from our experiences and evolving our practices. So how are we going to achieve healthcare as a human right? I actually would like to say, how are we going to achieve health as a human right? Because it's not just about access to healthcare. And many of you know that if we just tomorrow granted, you know, access to healthcare to every person, we wouldn't solve the health crises that we have in this country. We know that the social determinants of healthcare, which I think James and others touched on, you know, having adequate education, having a house to live in, having a job with a living wage, having access to healthy food, having access to clean water, clean air, being treated with dignity, all of these things, you know, being in community, these are things that make a huge difference in our health. And so it's a big task that we take on in trying to create a healthier population, and single payer is part of that. And in addition to that, we've got to see healthcare as part of this broader struggle for social, economic, and environmental justice. Because in this fight, we see that you know, whether it's, you know, education or the environment or healthy food or healthcare or worker rights, we're all facing the same obstacles. And we have a lot of crises going on right now in this country on a lot of fronts. But they are rooted in systems that are causing them. And I think Don Berwick, who is a pediatrician who was head of CMS for a while, and one of the things that I remember that he taught me is that, and maybe this is like, duh, everybody knows this, but it was just profound to me when I read it that he said this, just systems create what they're designed to create. So, you know, we're in this system and we're getting these results, that's because that's what this system does. And so if we want to change the results, we really have to change the system. Thanks. And so what are we looking at? You know, we're in this situation now, locally, nationally, globally, where we're in this drive towards commodification of everything.
Yeah.
Okay? And it's privatization of everything. And democracy, you know, democracy is under attack in this country. I mean, we just did our radio show this past week. We had a few guests from Detroit on our show. A member of the Detroit Public School Board who's operating in exile because the board was kicked out. They had a $100 million surplus and a $1.5 billion bond, and the state saw that and they wanted it. So they kicked out the school board, put in an emergency financial manager, and they've looted the entire amount. They've shut down schools. They're cutting the teachers. I mean, it's a situation where the kids' test scores are falling, and they're starting to look at alternatives, like can we do freedom schools? Can we do Saturday schools? Are there ways we can start to meet our student needs? And when the state had a ballot initiative to prohibit an emergency manager being put in place, and they passed that initiative, the state just rewrote the law and undermined that whole work, and just, you know, so much for democracy, right? So this is the situation that we're in. I mean, this is something that We have done, as a country, not us personally, but our you know, policy as a country has been to do this throughout the world in the global south, and now we're seeing it. It's worked so well there, it's coming back home to here. And so this is like, it's not fun to talk about these things, but we really have to understand the reality of the situation that we're in. And I call it an epidemic of neoliberalism. You know, it is. It's just, it's everywhere on every front. This is what we're facing. And so there are all these crises, but at the same time, I don't get down about those crises because they're also opportunities. And they're opportunities for us to think boldly and act boldly and change the system and create systems that actually won't create these outcomes, that will actually create a more just world, a more equal world, a more sustainable and peaceful world. So this is a huge opportunity, and it's up to us to take this opportunity and be bold and make these changes, and it's very exciting to see Shama doing that here in Seattle. So I'm really glad that you opened up some space for me, both of you, because I think, you know, if we're going to look at the root causes, and I've had pushback, you know, from saying these things, but we have to be able to say that capitalism is the problem, right? You know? We have to say that a system which requires growth, where profit reigns and people and the planet can be exploited, is a system that needs to change. We can't have that system anymore. But we also have to look at the other systems that are out there. We have to look at imperialism. A world, you know, a country where we're spending so much of our tax dollars on creating violence and instability all over the world, and not using those resources here at home to lift up our own population. We have to talk about racism. I mean, it is deeply ingrained in our country. And so as social justice activists, if we don't want to keep making the same mistakes, we have to confront this and deal with it and talk about it and learn how this has happened, what sustains it, and how we change that. We have to talk about colonialism, because the American genocide is continuing. And it's a history that many people, our children, are not taught this history. But we still continue to exploit our Native American communities, and we need to stop doing that. Thank you. So today is the final day of the World Social Forum that's been going on in Tunisia. And the World Social Forum was started in response to something called the World Economic Forum, which happens every year in Davos. And at the World Economic Forum, all the global elites come together, and well, I don't know what they do there because they don't tell anybody what they do there. But I do know that they've put together something called the Global Redesign Initiative. And under this initiative, the basic philosophy, and we've been looking at this, it actually goes back to 1967, and I'm blanking on his name, Kevin. The guy, Walt, what's the guy in 1967 that said, George Ball. Thank you. So in 1967, George Ball said, nation states are just really outdated. You know, nation states, they're like obstacles, they get in the way, they're slow, they don't allow us to change. But corporations are so efficient because they can like take resources from one country and labor from another country, and they can make things and ship them to another place. And if things aren't, you know, if the resources aren't there anymore, they can just go to this other place. And so there was really this philosophy, this ideology starting to develop of, we need to get rid of nation states and replace them with multinational corporations making the decisions. And kind of, you know, de facto that's happened, right? The multinational corporations are determining our policies in many ways. They're determining how our workers are treated. They're determining the distribution of goods. And even there was a study this past year, if you didn't see it, by Gillens and Page out of Princeton and Northwestern, where they actually looked at the United States, you know, government, and looked at a 20-year period and the public policy that was passed, and they found that overwhelmingly our public policy was favoring the wealthy. And so they said, this is, you know, we live in a plutocracy. It's just, you know, now it's a scientific fact. And even at this last World Economic Forum, there was a reporter from Bloomberg News who was interviewing an economist from New York, and he said, He said, so tell me, how big is the plutocratic effect this year? You know? And the economist said, well, it's actually quite significant. You know? So, I mean, I don't make this up, but this is the situation that we're in, right? We're in a situation where this is the path. This is what they actually see our global governance becoming. And so we have to know this. We have to be armed with these facts so that we can figure out how we're going to change it, right? But we can change it. So a few years ago, Kevin and I learned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's an international agreement that had started being negotiated under President Bush, but he dropped it, and President Obama picked it up and ran with it. And so for more than 5 years now, this agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries has been negotiated in secret. It's the first time they ever classified the text of a trade agreement. And it's not actually a trade agreement. It's actually a treaty. But they don't want to call it a treaty, because if they did, it would be harder for, you know, they have to have the Senate pass it with a larger majority. So they call it a trade agreement. But really, of all the 29 chapters, very few are about trade. And much more, it's about getting through the back door of Congress the things that multinational corporations want. So thanks to WikiLeaks, again, they've the only way that we kind of know what's in this agreement is that they've leaked some of the portions, and they just leaked the investment chapter. And there's something called Investor State Dispute Settlement Tribunal that they've created. And this tribunal is, we've had some of it kind of under NAFTA, but this is like this tribunal on steroids. It's a tribunal where corporate lawyers on leave from their corporate jobs are the ones who serve as judges, and then they go back to their job. And it allows corporations to sue our governments, even at the local level, state level, federal level, if our laws to protect our public health or protect the planet get in the way of their expected profits. And so if you decide that you're going to, you know, you've raised the wages of your workers, but now that's going to interfere with profits, they can sue you for what they expected to make. And if we, as a community, can't cough up that much money, we're probably just going to change that law and lower our wages. So this is a direct hit to our local democracy and our sovereignty, not to mention that the laws that are, the provisions that are in this treaty, well, our laws will have to be harmonized with them. So it's directly, it's being negotiated in secret, and it's going to directly change our laws. So we learned about this, and not many people were talking about it. We would go to activist gatherings, and very few people knew about it, so we spent a lot of time writing about it. And this was really, you know, you mentioned the movement of movements. This was an opportunity to build a movement of movements, because it really affects everything that we care about, from the food that we eat to our health care, you know, you name it. So over these years, we've built, together with others, we've built this huge movement of movement, and now they're saying it's the largest coalition that's come together to fight one of these treaty agreements. And we've beat it back. They tried to introduce fast-track legislation that would allow them to rush it through Congress last January, and when they did that, there were 10 days of actions, tens of thousands of phone calls into Congress, hundreds of thousands of emails into Congress, and they dropped it. It went away. So now they've introduced it again, and they wanted to get it passed in March, and people have been rising up, and they've been protesting at their Congress members' offices, and we've been doing a lot of protests in Washington, D.C., and now they're saying that maybe the earliest they'll introduce it is mid-April. So the movement is working. It's working together. We're seeing labor stand up. Hello, yay. You know, labor has just, as a at the national level, they've just been allowing themselves to get hit over and over again, and they don't stand up to it. And this time they are standing up and putting resources into it, and that's a tremendous thing, and I hope it continues, you know, after this on a range of other issues. But so, you know, we, without the billions that the transnational corporations have come with, with just our ability to go to our members of Congress's offices and sit in and contact them and pressure them, we've been able to hold off this agreement. And our feeling is that because you beat back the WTO, and ever since then they haven't been able to move forward, and now they're trying this backdoor approach through the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, if we beat these back, we can say to them, this era is over, give up. You know, we need to do this a new way, because every time you try to do this, we're going to be on to you and we're going to stop you. So, sorry, that was my turn. Oh,
Seattle Monday.
Of course. And I would be totally remiss if I didn't mention that the Seattle City Council is voting on a resolution this Monday at 2 o'clock that is kind of what we call a TPP free zone, is to oppose fast track. and the TPP, so I hope that you'll be down there. We'll be there. So what do we see in this situation? We see that the traditional tools that we've used to change political power are not really sufficient in the situation that we're in. But there are tools that we can use. We can, you know, build this movement of movement, activate ourselves, and be willing to use civil resistance when we need to get the social change that we need. And back when the health reform process was moving through and I saw what was going on, we coined this acronym ICU. You know, we're in a crisis and we need the ICU. And that's partly my formula for the work that we do. And it's I stands for independent. We have to be independent of political party and hold to our agenda, to our issue, no matter if the politicians are with us. I mean, Shama's a breath of fresh air, and it's wonderful, and you're a rare bird, because no other politicians that I know of actually come out of the movement and are accountable to the movement in the way that you are, and we need more of that. But we have to be willing to be independent. We have to be clear about what we want. Like the table that we have, you know, we're always told what we want is off the table. Well, that table, you know, is a corrupt table. What we want is never going to be on that table. So we have to be clear about what we want, and we have to put it on that table. And then we have to be uncompromising about it. We recently were involved, as David said, in the net neutrality battle. And when we started that about a year ago, it was in April, the end of April, that the rules were leaked that the FCC was going to vote on. And these were rules that were going to create a tiered internet where it was discriminatory based on your ability to pay. And we knew that that was something that, for us as an organization, that was a fundamental, that was just going to destroy us. Because we already have the commercial media that, you know, is so powerful, and now we were going to see our internet, which is our freedom of speech in the 21st century, get turned into this corporatized, commodified medium. So we had to change that. And the coalition that we worked with didn't believe that we could get the internet reclassified as a common carrier, as it had been initially, even when we joined them and said, this is what we're going to do. And so when 8 days before the FCC hearing where they were going to announce what the rules were going to be, Kevin and I went down to the FCC and had a rally with others saying, oh my God, I have so much more to say. All right. And anyway, we occupied the FCC. We were alone at first, but we stayed there, and gradually others came, and by the end of the 8 days, we had the FCC, the whole side of the building covered. They put our agenda on the table. Millions of people spoke out and in support of it. We continued to protest them. We continued when the FCC was trying to put through a compromise, and people within our coalition were saying, well, let's try to make this a good compromise. We said, no, we're not making this a good compromise because it has loopholes. We have to go for the full thing, and we continued to pressure, and we won on February 26th. So that was very exciting. And when we have these wins, we're actually winning for single payer, because what we're doing is we're shifting the power. And we're learning, because the people in that coalition learned, and this was really new to them, that when you are not compromising and when you're willing to get in their face and block their cars and protest outside the FCC, that they will give in. And as you know, you discover over and over again how little sometimes, it's surprising how little it can take when you get in their face, because they're just not used to that. So, all right, so what we're doing, we promote a two-path approach of stopping the things that are really harmful and then creating alternatives that we want to grow up and replace the current systems that we have. So we call it Stop the Machine, Create a New World. And what's beautiful is that within that strategy, there's room for everybody to be doing the work that you're caring about, and to see that you're part of this broader movement, whether you're, you know, working to create an alternative clinic here, or you know, you're working to stop a harmful policy. You're all together, you're part of this movement. So what is my, I want to talk about where we are as a movement. Because we look at the phases of successful social movements, and we're in what is called phase 6. And phase 7 is actually winning, and phase 8 is defending that win and moving on to the next struggle. And in phase 6, what's really important is a couple of things. Political education, and I feel like you guys are really, you know, you're getting that. And so much across the country, more and more people are getting that. Of understanding that there's a problem, that the current situation can't fix that problem. And then the next step is building national consensus for what the solutions are. So we want to have a supermajority of people that support the solutions, but then you only need to mobilize out on the streets about 3.5% of the population. The research shows that if we can mobilize 3.5% of the population, No government of any form has stood up to that. So this is achievable, right? We can do this. We can build this movement of movement. We can learn how to be successful. We can get these gains and continue to build off of that and win. So I feel really hopeful about where we're going as a in the future, although it's a difficult struggle. I'm not going to go into the Affordable Care Act, but it falls right in there with the neoliberal, economic model. It's sucking our public dollars into a private system that's continuing to deny and restrict care. It's moving us in the opposite direction of where we need to go, farther towards a market-based, privatized healthcare system, and we need to pull it back the other way. So our job as a movement is to be outspoken about that. We can't be afraid to say that. People need to understand that we're going in the wrong direction so that we can go back in the other direction. We need to work in solidarity. I mean, others have already said this, that, we need to go to where others are doing their actions and say to them, how can we support you? How can we participate with you? Because what we're really doing in building this movement of movements is building relationships and building community and getting to know each other and talk to each other and, find out who each other are so that we can work together to stop things and to create the kind of society that we want to live in. And I think I just want to close with, and we'll get onto the panel, that... And this is something that I think Quentin has always told me, is that this is a long struggle, right? This is a lifetime struggle for all of us. And so there may be times when you can participate out in the streets and be there, and there may be times when you can't. But that's okay, because we're all still part of this movement, and we have to take care of ourselves. Ha-ha, I'm sick, but... But we have to take care of ourselves and recognize that we have to find ways that we can also support ourselves and support each other so that we can stay in this struggle together. And so I want to thank you for inviting me to be here tonight, and I look forward to our further discussion.